Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, February 18th, 2007, and this is show number 83. Man, did I have a fun week, and I figured out what I want for Mother's Day this year. I know, you're thinking, how could Steve possibly top the power washer he got me last year? I have the perfect idea. I want a chainsaw. My friend Nancy loaned me hers, and it's awesome. I should probably be more specific. What she loaned me is called the Black & Decker Alligator Lopper. It's like these massive jaws of death that you clamp on a branch, and as you clamp the jaws of death together, you also squeeze the triggers on both handles, and that lets loose the chainsaw that's embedded in one of the jaws. It's so awesome, you can't believe it. I even had my friend Melanie over, and my neighbor Tammy came by so they could play with it too. Because of the clamping action, you can actually hold the chainsaw in one place, so it's not really as dangerous. The chainsaw can't go, you know, bouncing all over the place and cut your leg off quite as easily. I mean, you'd have to clamp to it first. And use the squeezing together of the jaws to actually make sure that it cuts in the right place and squeezes all the way through. It's really cool. Well, I've been wanting to hack back my bougainvillea for a long time, or as we affectionately call them, the boogs. I've been wanting to do this for ages because they're getting really tall. I've tried doing it by hand, but I cut my arms up something fierce. It took forever, and my hands were paralyzed for days after just hacking back one of them. Well, armed with a chainsaw and a pair of long-handled hand clippers, I was able to beat them one of them into submission in just a couple hours. Okay, like 3 hours. It was scary, though. Picture this. I've got a chainsaw held above my head, and the boogs are like this intertwined set of hard, vine-like branches with these massive spikes up and down on the branches. And so I've got like this 3-foot diameter ball of these spike-like branches weighing probably like 25 pounds above my head. Well, maybe 10 pounds. Anyway, it's held on by some last little snotty little branch that I can't seem to find. So I'm yanking this ball of death back and forth. And did I mention I'm standing on the top step of a 6-foot ladder? Well, I told Lindsay to dial 9 and 1 and just hold for a minute to see if she should push the last one. I had even strategized how I was going to throw my body to the left onto the shrubbery that was to my left as I tried to hurl this ball of scary stuff off to my right if I fell. Anyway, I had her take some pictures of me working, and you can also see the giant ball of death on the ground behind me in one of the pictures. She took a little video too, which is pretty cool. You can see this chainsaw thing working. I can't wait to get my own for Mother's Day. Gonna be great. Hey, a lot of activities going on over in the new and improved spam-free forums, so be sure to go over to the website and check that out. We got a lot of interesting discussions going on. Listener Jeremy put up a rather pointed post that I kind of threw back to him, and we got into an interesting debate, and all in good fun and enjoying ourselves, but some good constructive criticism there too, so the debate has been interesting. Really encourage you to head on over to the forums. Look for the link in the show notes. Well, I guess it's back to time I get to high tech again here. Last November, listener Ryan sent me a list of a whole bunch of freeware apps that he liked. And as you know, I've been working my way slowly through them. One I hadn't looked at yet is called Schoolhouse 2 from LogansCollins.com. And it requires Mac OS X 10.4 Tiger. Ryan describes Schoolhouse as an excellent application for handling school assignments. You can manage almost any kind of assignment, from exams to homework to projects, and if you input the grades for the assignments, you can get an approximation of your grade for your classes. He does point out that it doesn't allow you to set weights for different types of assignments like many teachers do, so it won't be as precise as you probably would like. Well, I remember like 126 years ago when I was in school, and it sounds like this might have helped me organize my assignments and keep track of what I was doing. So I decided to check it out. The interface of Schoolhouse 2 is very clean and very Mac-like. There's a big green plus button to add assignments, a big red minus button to remove them. Oh, They were only so easy to remove. Now, when you add an assignment, you set the priority, the due date, and then use a pull-down to define the course. When you first start, though, you don't have any courses to choose from, and it took me a little while to figure out how to add them. If you right-click in the left-hand sidebar, one option is to add a course. The courses include information on where the class takes place, what time it is, and information about the instructor, like their name and email address. Once you've set up your courses, now you can add assignments easily and check them off when they're complete. You can export them to iCal either as events or to-do lists. You can email them, but I'm not sure why'd you want to do that. Maybe if you wanted a reminder on a portable device. Speaking of portable devices, you can also send assignments to your iPod. I didn't have my iPod connected, but it did say that if I had, I would have had to make sure it was set up for disk use. Sounds like the assignment would go in just as a text file, not part of the calendar if you did that. Guess you'd get that if you sent it to iCal and you had your iCal syncing to the iPod, which is a pretty cool thing that I do use. One thing I'd like to see is more flexibility in column widths. It seems to hit some limits and not let you pull it in and out as far as you'd really like to when you're working with the interface. While Schoolhouse doesn't have weighted grading, which is definitely a detraction from the grade portion of this tool, in the calculator, it has a section where you can calculate what grade you'd have to get on the final in order to get a specific grade in the class, and it lets you use weighted grades in there. One of the best parts is when you complete an assignment, it changes the text to green. It puts a nice green diagonal banner across the assignment that says, "Done." I know, it's a small thing, but it was really pleasing to see that nice "Done" banner. It makes me feel very accomplished, and I didn't even do any homework. Well, after I wrote this review, I went over to the website for Schoolhouse, and I happened to take a look at the forums. And unfortunately, Logan's forums were being overrun with spam, just like mine were. I was kind of concerned about doing this review, and then we told kids to go to the site. They might see things we didn't want them to see. Heck, we'd see things we didn't want to see. So I wrote to Logan and talked to him about it. I felt funny telling another webmaster what to do with their site, but he was very gracious. Here's what he wrote back. "Allison, thank you for your interest. I love to hear when people are excited about Schoolhouse. I've just recently started reworking my forums and have implemented a completely new one in BBPress. You are absolutely right. The old one was underused mainly because of the spam problem. I have to apologize for its previous condition as I had not cleared it for some time. The new form is not completely functional yet, but has no spam problem as of now, so feel free to publish your review. Logan." Isn't that cool? Like I said, I thought it might be presumptuous of me to suggest that he switch over to BBPress and maybe use some McKismet in there for spam control, but as always, the freeware author shows graciousness and style. So go check out Schoolhouse 2 from logansCollins.com. All right, this next one, a review comes from my son Kyle, which means it will not increase your productivity in any way. That's just not what Kyle is all about. The website he showed me is called linerider.com. Okay, here's the deal. You draw a line, and a little stick man riding on a sled with a red scarf on slides down the line that you drew. All right, well, that sounds pretty simplistic. But this is an amazing addictive game, and people have made some amazing rides. Turns out the color of the line you use to draw with changes how the sled reacts. So if you just draw with the blue line, he goes at some normal speed. But if you draw with the red line, he accelerates, so you can have him accelerate up a curve. And then the green line is just for drawing scenery. Once you've drawn a curve, you push the play button to make him go. And you stop when he starts falling endlessly because he fell off the end of your line. You can add to your drawing, erase sections, and even save your path. To make it easier to make highly complex paths, you can put a flag down at certain spots, and he'll start from there each time as you build the next section. Like I said, people have been wasting hours and probably days and weeks making paths for this little guy, including elaborate scenery, you know, mountains and houses and dragons, and I mean, it's there's one with a dump truck that I put in the website that is just amazing. These things go on for like 10 minutes. So you should go check out the link in the show notes. The one I put in there was linewritervideos.blogspot.com. You can see how nuts people have gotten with this. I think you'd be glad to know that my son discovered this important tool while he was supposed to be receiving his higher education in his journalism class. Glad to know our tax dollars are going to good cause. Now, when I find him playing line writer at home, he says, "Hey, Mom, I'm studying." Oh, well, what are you going to do? Well, let's have a word from our sponsor. One of the great things about Honda Bob is that he looks at things the right way. What I mean by that is, if you're not a mechanic, you're not going to know what's wrong with your car. You're only going to be able to identify symptoms, right? Like, I don't call up Bob and say, "Hey, Bob, the electronic control unit in the manifold isn't providing positive pressure to the power steering pump, so we should definitely put in new fuel injectors." No, that's not exactly what I would say. Instead, I'd say things like, the CD skips, or the antenna won't extend fully, or the brake pedal sinks in too far. Well, over at hdabob.com, Bob has a great section called Index of Symptoms. He must have 30 or 40 symptoms listed, and then a link to where you can learn more about that section on his website, where that part of the car is explained. For example, if you find that your car won't idle smoothly, he takes you to his explanation of how the carburetor works. Such a great educator, and he puts in a lot of time creating this free site for us so we can learn more about our cars. Maybe it won't make us into mechanics, but maybe it will make us more educated if we go into a dealer who tries to take advantage of us. Of course, I would never go to a dealer because HDA Bob comes right to my house and does a great job every time. I really can't recommend his mobile service any more than I've said. I mean, he's just amazing, and he's been taking care of my cars for 29 years, so not only would I not go anywhere else, I can't buy anything but a Honda or an Acura for pretty much the rest of my life, so what are you going to do? Let's kick into our Google reviews. This is now time for part 12. Well, as if Google weren't in our heads enough, there's another idea incubating in the labs called Google Suggest. It's at a really screwy URL, so just go to the show notes to see it if you're interested. The idea of Google Suggest is that as you type, Google will suggest what you might be wanting to search for. Looks pretty much like regular Google when you bring it up, but as you type, it starts to guess what you might want and gives you a list of suggestions. And for the words I tried, it seemed to anticipate my needs quite well. I knew I'd seen this feature somewhere before, and then I remembered it was over on Answers.com, one of my favorite search sites. This came in really handy when I was looking up country names in the early days of the podcast, because I didn't have to be able to spell the whole country name before it would just swoop in and finish the rest of it for me. I haven't talked about Answers.com in ages, but if you haven't used it before, I highly recommend it as a way to find lots of information about a certain topic categorized into different type things. Like if when I typed in country names, it would have a section on geography and a section on politics and a section on language and people and those kinds of things. So instead of just being all these random hits about a country, you could really kind of specify it, see maps, all kinds of stuff. Since I was curious about this feature, I went back over to Answers.com, and they have a new interface that's very clean. They also have a new tagline. They say they are the world's greatest encyclodictionalmanacopedia. Well, that actually describes their service pretty down well. Google Suggest came out in 2004, so maybe they came up with this Suggest idea first, but this one really hasn't been incubated into anything more interesting than that one little feature. So if I wanted that feature, I'd go over to Answers.com before going to Google Suggest. Next up is Google Sets from labs.google.com/sets. The problem this evidently is supposed to solve is to automatically create sets of items from a few examples. Okay, what's that supposed to mean? Well, if you hit example, it populates the first three fields with BMW, Honda, and Mercedes-Benz. All right, what's that about? Well, then at the bottom, you have two buttons, large set and small set, 15 items or fewer. Okay, I still don't know what they're doing, but if you select one of these buttons, it comes up with a list of predicted items, all of the same type. So the set that they put in BMW, Honda, and Mercedes-Benz, when you push the button, it populated it with Toyota, Nissan, Ford, etc. Putting in the name of three Tom Cruise movies returned a list of a bunch more movies by him, As luck would have it, I owned 11 of the ones on the list, which has nothing to do with this review. Well, I really can't think what you'd want to do with this tool. I mean, maybe there's a word you can't think of, and you know a bunch of words that are like it, and maybe it would lead you to it. Can't for the life of me come up with a better problem than this one solves, so let's just move on. Well, it looks like we might be back to our theme from last week. This next Google tool doesn't work under Safari. It's called Google Documents and Spreadsheets, and it's from docs.google.com. I know you're saying that you already learned about Google Spreadsheet when it first came out, but that was actually 8 months ago, so I figure they've probably made some progress since then, don't you think? I also haven't looked at the documents portion yet at all. So I can't believe I'm starting this review like this again, but get rid of Safari and switch over to Firefox in order to play with Docs and Spreadsheets. Docs and Spreadsheets starts with New Document, New Spreadsheet, and Upload is the first three options. I clicked on New Document first and typed in some goofy stuff. I was able to change fonts to a fairly limited set, maybe 15 or so, change style and color, or highlight the text. It has support for bulleted or numbered lists, indenting, and making fancy quotes. Left, center, and right justify are just clicks of a button. Well, I noticed a link button, so I selected a word and found that I could link that text not just to a web page, but to a file within documents and spreadsheets. I could also define the flyover text. That's the text that shows up when you hover over the link. And I could choose whether or not the linked location or file would open in a new window, or if it would open right in that same window. The only downside was that the link didn't actually work. I tried it linked to a file and to a URL, and neither one of the links did a darn thing. Well, of course, this is beta. I played around in the Insert tab, too. I was able to easily insert an image into my document by clicking on Insert, and then the Image button, and browsing to the image on my disk. I would have thought I'd also be able to point to the URL of an image already on the web, but that wasn't there as an option. They have a way to make the image a link, but at least there they tell you that it's not supported yet. They're going to have it in there soon. I also inserted a table, and it had some nice functions. I could choose how many rows and columns, what color it was, how it would be sized, you know, like percent of page, full width, or size to content. Turns out once you put it in, you can actually stretch it and shrink it too. Once I had the table in place, I found I could insert and delete rows and columns with the little symbols on the table or in the Insert Table menu. But I couldn't really do much else. For instance, I wanted to go back and change the padding and color on the table, but I couldn't get back to that original menu that had those choices that I used when I first inserted it. That seems funny. It seems like I ought to be able to get to that. Maybe it's in there somewhere. I didn't find it, though. One of the major powers of Google Docs and Spreadsheets is that it allows collaboration. I invited Bart to collaborate with me on my silly little document. First, I wrote up some slop, and then he wrote up some more slop. In the Revisions tab, I can now see where and when I edited the document and where and when he messed around. The only problem I had was I show up in there as me, and the email address he happened to give me was called me at his own URL, so it says me and me, which confused me for a while. But anyway, I figured it out. It shows in highlights the changes he made, so you can step back through revisions, and for each revision, it shows you the highlighted changes that he made or I made, and it also identifies when we made those changes. That worked pretty well, actually. In order to get him to collaborate with me, all I had to do was click on Collaborate and then enter his email address as a collaborator. You can also invite people just to be viewers. Right about then, I noticed a preview button. So I clicked it, and it showed you my document, how it would look when it was right out on the web. And I got a wild idea. I clicked on my link again, and of course it worked perfectly. So it doesn't work while you're doing editing, but it does work in the finished document. So even though I jumped to conclusions there and said that it didn't work, I feel I created a valuable learning opportunity for you, so you'll not make the same hasty judgment. I did notice that a few times I stumbled on giving info into one of the pop-up windows, and then the window would stop responding. For example, when I was in the Insert Table menu, I clicked on the Color button. And when it didn't react as quickly as I expected, and I clicked again, I'm impatient, I know. Well, it popped up with the color options, but then it closed them right quick and would never give me the color options again, unless I closed and reopened it. Well, the same thing happened when I tried to insert a link and I made a mistake. It chastised me and took me back to the pop-up window, but I couldn't edit any of the fields. I had to close it and open it again. I hope they work on that, because that was kind of annoying. The output options are interesting. You can save this as an HTML file, which would be zipped so you can move it somewhere and then expand it out on a website. They also have support for RTF, which stands for Rich Text Format. That's a pretty universal format most text editors can read. They also have support for Word, OpenOffice, or PDF formats for export. You can also publish your document to the web, and then they give you a link to send to people. I went ahead and published the slop Bart and I wrote, and I put a link in the show notes to it so you can see how it looks. I told you it's slop, so don't expect brilliance. Hey, I just noticed as I'm editing here, there's even a spell check button at the bottom. Overall, I think Google Documents is pretty cool. It's very fast considering it's a web-based application. Its collaboration capabilities are really nice. And take note that if you edit your document after you publish it, you have to republish it for the changes to take effect. Other than a few difficulties with tables and a hinky menu here and there, I have to say it's a lot more intuitive than using Microsoft Word. But then again, what isn't more intuitive than Microsoft Word? Oh, yeah, PowerPoint. PowerPoint is actually worse than Word. Oh, well. Well, the one Microsoft application I do adore is Excel. Unlike the aforementioned applications, I find it easy to use and incredibly powerful. I learn something new and how to use it practically weekly, and I'd say I am really a power user. I rarely find myself swearing at it, though, like I do other applications from Microsoft. So Google Spreadsheets has a lot to live up to because I really do like Excel. As you might remember, in my first tests of spreadsheets, it actually had a math error. Summing up versus summing down got two different answers, so I better check that out right away. I had to find two numbers that I could actually add in my head, remember my complete impairment in the arithmetic category, and so I went to spreadsheets and I picked 3 plus 5, because last time I checked that it was like, I don't know, 7, 8, 9, something like that, and luckily spreadsheets correctly got the number 8 as I summed up or summed down. Okay, first test passed. The second thing I didn't like was how the sort function worked last time. I tried it again. I selected four numbers in a column, and the top number was not in the first row, but rather was partway down the page. I clicked on Sort A to Z, and it moved the numbers to the top of the spreadsheet, just like it did last time. Well, okay, they were definitely sorted, but who said I wanted them moved? I never told them I wanted to do that. What if their location was important to the rest of the document? This is definitely a bug, if not really poor design. One nice surprise was how many functions are available in Google Spreadsheets. Across the top, it lists just a few, you know, like average and sum and things like that. But if you click on more, you get a plethora of functions sorted into math, financial, logical, date, lookup, and even more. Hey, remember when I said that the color palette wouldn't come up again when I was trying to change the color of a table over in Google Documents? Well, right while I was doing this part of the review, I slid my Firefox window open, and underneath it was that darn color palette. Oh well, at least I found it. It was just hidden underneath. Maybe it would still work if I knew how to find it last time. Well, back to Google Spreadsheets. One of my favorite functions in Excel is called VLOOKUP. It stands for Vertical Lookup. The use for this is let's say you've got a huge gob of data in one page and another huge gob of data in another page, and you need to look up values from one and return information from another. Kind of hard to explain unless you have a document up you need to do that with, but it's really valuable when you need it. I was a little worried that they wouldn't have functions of this complexity in Google Spreadsheets, but sure enough, it was in there. Then I was worried they wouldn't explain how to use it, because it's pretty complicated. Even though, like I said, I'm a power user, I usually have to mess around with it for half an hour each time I try to get it to work. And I even save examples, and I look at those, and I can't figure it out. And then I Google my friend Nancy, the one with the chainsaw. I get her to help me get it to work in the end, every single time. So I was kind of worried would they have the right kind of instructions there. Well, it turns out, if you select a function, it gives you the format first of what you need to type in, and then there's a link that says more, which takes you to a full description of how to get it to work. So that was a relief. A pretty basic thing I rely on for ease of use of a spreadsheet is the ability to freeze panes. That means to freeze a few rows or columns so they're always showing as you scroll sideways and up and down. Imagine you've got a bunch of headings across the top and 300 rows of information. Well, in order to see those headings, you need to freeze those. Well, Google Spreadsheet does allow you to use this to do this, but in a very restricted manner. You can only freeze rows, you can't freeze columns, and your choice is only the top 1 to 5 rows. This is way too limiting. I frequently freeze rows that are way down in the middle of a document. They really did not implement this part well, I'm afraid. Another surprising thing is how slow this application scrolls. I'm talking like more than a full second for every row I scroll by using the arrow keys. That's just goofy. Maybe it works better in Windows. It did work fine if I used the little scroll elevator. I could scroll it up and down, you know, drag it up and down, and the rows would fly by. But man, using the arrows, it would just go way too slow. Way too slow. Overall, I gotta say, I remain disappointed with Google Spreadsheets, and I don't think I really set the bar that high, because basic functionality that I would expect isn't there, and yet these advanced functions are. So I decided not to poke around with it anymore. And unlike Documents, which is a pretty complete product, Google Spreadsheets just has too many missing or weirdly implemented features to consider using it on a day-to-day basis. So I guess we'll come back in another 6 months and see if they've made any progress. A while ago, I told you about one of my favorite products of the last year, probably, the great program Pando. It's a cross-platform application that allows us to transfer huge files or batches of files, like if you got 50 pictures from a birthday party and you want to send the whole batch over, you can do that in one group just as though you're emailing them. You know, I play with a lot of applications each week, and this is one that I still use over and over again. It's in my stock group of best applications. I'm so happy when I suggest someone uses it and they give it a try. You know, it's a light, easy download with a great interface, and then they do it, and they realize, man, they're going to depend on this now. Hannah Bob wanted to send me an 87-megabyte PowerPoint show he created, which, by the way, will be featured next week on the podcast, and I suggested he try using Pando for the job. Without a flinch, he downloaded it, installed it, and sent the file right on over to me. I love that he's a geek, and, you know, in my world, that's a compliment for sure. Anyway, the reason I bring up Pando again is that I had sent a batch of files to my daughter, and then my husband wanted the photos too, so I had to upload them all over again to use Pando. I wondered if the files were still up on the server at Pando, which they said they would be. Why did I have to upload them again? I wrote to my friend Shlomit over at pando.com, and here's what he said. Hi, Allison. I was very happy to read your feedback. This is exactly what Pando is for. As for your request to forward a Pando package, this functionality is actually readily available. You can find instructions here at pando.com/help-forward-win09. Forwarding a package is instantaneous and does not require uploading the files again. Hope this answers your questions. Shlomit. Well, I went over to that link and I read the instructions and I was pretty embarrassed. Turns out that all you do is hit the forward button on Pando when you have the file you either sent or received selected. And that's it. That's all you have to do. I should have known it was easy and intuitive. These guys have written such a terrific product. I should have just looked to see if it was in there. Well, thanks, Shlomit, for the quick feedback and help for an impaired brain user. A few months ago, we had a good discussion on ways to make YouTube videos from the internet, take YouTube videos from the internet, and move them onto your iPod. This week, I found out about a slick little Mac shareware application called TubeSock from Stinkbot.com. You just gotta love the name of their website, if nothing else. Anyways, TubeSock makes all these other methods obsolete. It's not free, but $15 might be worth how fun and easy this is. Here's all you do. You launch TubeSock, cut and paste it into the URL for the YouTube video into TubeSock, and hit save. That's it. You're done. Take the URL, stick it in TubeSock, you're done. TubeSock downloads and converts the video to iPod format and adds it to your iTunes library. I'm serious. It's one step. Well, if that's too easy for you and you like a lot of complexity, you can fiddle with some of the settings. The default is to save in video for iPod format H.264. H.264 is a fancy name for a compression algorithm that's really good for the file size it makes. You can optionally choose video for iPod as an MP4. You can also choose to save for the Trio, PSP, or even the iPhone. I wonder how they know what format the iPhone wants. It's probably the same as the iPod, but they just thought it'd look cool to have that in there. TubeSock also will save the file to your Mac, your Apple TV, or just as an FLV file. You can even have it save the audio only, which is pretty cool too. You can change the setting of Add to iTunes to Add to Movies or just save to any old location. You can download a free trial version, but they only let you convert 30 seconds of video, so you'll want to shell out the $15 after you realize how easy and cool it is. I don't think $15 is too much to ask for how much fun this is. Now, you might be thinking, what else could I want than all of these great features? Well, what if you had a lot of videos you wanted to download? Would it be tedious to add these URLs one at a time and wait for the videos to convert before you could add the next one? Some folks wrote a freeware application called TubeSock Loader, which lets you load a bunch of URLs into it, and then it does the work of opening TubeSock, loading one URL, telling it to save, and then starting the next one. Man, how lazy are we? The developer's URL, for some reason, resolved to a Flickr account. Not quite sure what happened there, but the pictures were really cool over there and distracted me for about 20 minutes. But anyway, I went back and put the link in for versiontracker.com where you can get to the download. I like to always direct people to the real developer, but in this case, I couldn't find the real developer. So go over to the show notes and you can see the link to Version Tracker for TubeSock Loader. You can also find TubeSock over there too. Well, TubeSock Loader does have a really cool icon. I should mention that. Looks like a sock. So I was yapping to a big group of people about how awesome podcasting is, trying to get them excited about it. But the one thing I got stuck on was what to recommend for recording a podcast on Windows. I use GarageBand on my Mac, which is awesome and made for podcasting now. But before that, I used the open source tool Audacity. Audacity runs under Windows, which is cool, Windows and the Mac, and that's really nice, but it's a little bit hinky. And I found that I had to mess around with the levels a lot every time I went in order to have the right volume. And there were some bugs in the way the volume worked on it too. The other thing that worried me about telling others who might not have the strong geek gene was that you also have to download the open source LAME encoder, which you need to have installed in order for Audacity to create the necessary MP3 files. So anyway, here I am yapping about how I'm stuck on I don't know what to recommend, when one of the guys I was talking to says, well, why don't you just recommend QuickTime Pro? It runs under OS 10 and Windows, and it does a fine job of audio recording. I say, what? I've owned QuickTime Pro for years and years, and never once did I notice that you can record within it. I launched it. Sure enough, right under File, it says New Audio Recording. I selected that, hit the big red record button, recorded a message, and it sounded fine. You don't get the nice wave patterns that you get in GarageBand or some of the other applications, and the ability to cut in sound files and mix it and all that stuff isn't there. But if you're making a straight recording, it could not have been easier. When I went to hit save, it wanted to save it as an MOV file. I went over to Export instead, and there I could choose from a multiple of choices, none of which were MP3. I figure this is part of that whole thing of licensing the MP3 encoder. I think that's the problem. The default file type is AIFF, which is fine, I guess, because then all you have to do is open it in iTunes, then you right-click on it and say Convert to MP3, which is what I do with the podcast anyway. I kind of wish it were in one step, though. That would have been easier. The TubeSock people would have made it one step. Anyway, while I was looking for the new audio recording, I realized that there's also a new movie recording option, too. How cool is this? When I chose that, it started up my built-in EyeSight camera. There's that big red record button. I thought you guys would be thrilled to see a video of me, so I made a 15-second clip using QuickTime Pro and put it in the show notes. I have to say that QuickTime Pro is really easy to use for both audio and video recording. There are some rudimentary tools to trim the video and audio using sliders at the bottom, and you can cut and paste pieces together. But if you had a really long recording, it could get pretty tedious and difficult to use this as an editor. If you do pretty much one-shot takes like I do, you can tell I don't do much editing, right? Well, maybe QuickTime Pro would help you out. QuickTime Pro is $30 from apple.com/QuickTime, but I have to warn you, that's $30 every time they come out with a new version. I've paid it twice, and I find it useful, but I did want to warn you that you knew that before you run out and buy it. Well, I have to take a quick intermission here to talk about how much I love the internet. As I was writing up my show notes about QuickTime Pro, and I just made my 15-second little intro video, I had to figure out how to put the video into the show notes. In the past, I've done all kinds of weird things to get it to work, but in all cases, if you clicked on the video, it would open a new browser tab or a new window and then play the movie over there. I figured there must be a tricky way to get it embedded into the blog, but I didn't have the vaguest idea to do that, how to do that. So I went over to Google and I typed in QuickTime embed blog. The very first hit was to channel-ai.com/blog/plugins. The developer, and I'm not exactly sure, is Yeo Sanger, and he's written this fantastic, simple little plugin for WordPress that lets me embed QuickTime right into my blog. I'm telling you, it was like 6 minutes from when I got the idea to look for this until I had it installed on my WordPress server and running, making my videos look perfect embedded in the blog. This is the power of the internet and the power of creative and generous people like AI. I really recommend you go over to channel-ai.com and check out the other things going on at that site. It's very, very interesting over there. I just love the internet, don't you? All right, so I just finished convincing you that you really should shell out $30 for QuickTime Pro so you can make quick and easy audio and video recordings, right? Well, QuickTime Pro's big virtue here is it has one button for record, right? Well, what if I could show you an application that does the exact same thing, but did it for free? Right after I discovered what QuickTime Pro can do, Bart tells me about iRecord from mindsprockets.com. It's a freeware universal application for Mac OS X that gives you quick, simple, elegant video recording for the Mac. I thought it might be fun if we did a fly-off, so I ran iRecord right after QuickTime. iRecord is only 244 kilobytes in size. Not megabytes, I'm talking kilobytes here. So it's sure worth the horrible effort of paying nothing and getting a quarter of a megabyte down there. Well, I mean, who can't afford 244 kilobytes of space anyway? Well, I launched iRecord, and it looks an awful lot like QuickTime Record when you choose New Movie Recording. All you have is that one big red record button. I put a picture of the two applications side by side so you can see how similar they are. iRecord has only the one red button for record, but I noticed then that QuickTime Pro has the red record button, but it also has a timer showing how long you've been yapping and an indicator of how big your movie is getting in megabytes of space. Kind of nice to have those two features. Not crucial, but definitely useful. Another thing you get with QuickTime Pro is one of those scales that shows how loud your voice is, or whatever sound is being recording. I know there's a big old technical word for that scale, but you know, it's the thing that turns red if you're yelling too loud into the mic and it's kind of topping out. That's good to know, so you know you have a reasonable sound level. I made a recording in each application under essentially the same conditions. When I finished the QuickTime Pro recording, it played back in QuickTime at the normal size it was recorded. When I finished recording in iRecord, it popped the recording open in QuickTime, which was nice, but it opened it up way, way, way too big. I mean, like a half a nostril on the screen big. I mean, it was huge. So I tried going to normal size, but it kept it that big. Half size was an improvement, but it was still way bigger than the natural resolution. Finally, I just grabbed the bottom right-hand corner and shrank it until it looked smooth and good. Guess this isn't a big problem, not that hard to fix, but I suspect this is some error in the way the file is saved, and might be something the people over at Mindsprockets would be able to fix. iRecord doesn't allow you to do any editing of the file, but hey, QuickTime Pro's editing features aren't anything to write home about anyway. I should mention that iRecord actually comes with a user manual. They call it Quick Start, and it's about one page long, including some graphics. I did learn something about iRecord in looking at the Quick Start. You can take a snapshot with iRecord by simply dragging what the camera is showing in iRecord down to a folder. They said it would make a TIFF file, but what I got was picture clipping. I was able to open it in the Finder, but not in other image editing programs like Photoshop Elements. Either I did something wrong, which is highly likely I misunderstood, or this feature doesn't work quite right yet. I think iRecord is a terrific little application that fits the freeware bill, and it does 90% of what QuickTime Pro does for video recordings. If Mindsprocket fixes that weird size issue, I'd probably use iRecord before I'd pay $30 for QuickTime Pro. Thanks for the great freeware tip, Bart. Well, it looks like that's going to wind it up for this week's installment of the NoSillaCast. I sure hope you'll stop by the new and clean forums at podfeet.com/forums_bbpress. I keep promising I'm going to make that less complicated soon, and I will, but didn't get around to it yet. As always, send me email feedback at allison@podfeet.com and voice recordings at nosillacast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.